dividing up the lectures. So now we are on lecture 7, transportation. This might seem a bit weird as a topic. You know, this course is called American Society, How It Really Works. Transportation seems like a pretty specialized little corner of the world. Doesn't have quite the standing in most people's view of how to think about a society that the environment or healthcare, which we'll be dealing with, those seem like big areas. Transportation seems like a kind of small niche, a small specialized topic. And perhaps that's true. I use it as an example because it illustrates really sharply a whole range of issues around the nature of American society and how it really works with respect to something which actually has quite a lot of ramifications in people's lives and which could be organized in a very different way that most people would find advantageous. So it's a good example to really focus our attention on. The simplest way to think about this is that transportation always involves a combination of privately provided means of transportation and public transportation. Every system always involves both. Imagine if we lived in a world in which all transportation services were provided privately. What would this mean? It would mean that streets would have to be privately produced and privately regulated. Imagine if all streets in a city were produced by private entrepreneurs. There would be tolls at every corner. Whenever you entered a new private property street and you wanted to use it, you'd have to pay a toll. And of course, with modern technologies, you might be able to do it with little easy pass, you know, transponders on your vehicle. So you'd be paying tolls to different entrepreneurs who were building and paving different parts of the city streets. You can imagine if we really relied on private provision of all of our transportation infrastructure, of everything, there would be a big underprovision of good quality streets in parts of the country, in parts of cities. To have a good street system in cities and a good highway system between cities, it's almost impossible to imagine how you can do this well without us getting together collectively and deciding how to pay for it. The market simply isn't going to provide adequate basic public infrastructure. So the question then really is not whether we should have no public transportation, whether it should all be private, but rather how should we combine the public and private faces of public transportation. And that's what I want to look at and explore some of the complexities of that problem. First, let's just look at some facts of the matter. These statistics are in the book, so you don't have to madly try to write them down here. The purpose of this is just to show you how things differ elsewhere in the world compared to the United States and how it's changed over time. The United States wasn't always the way it is today. So the first graph looks at the percentage of urban trips by type of transportation in the mid-1990s, where there are three types: walking, bicycling, and public transportation. And you can see the United States is the lowest of all three of these. These are all of the non-car forms of transportation, right? So you think of transportation as divided into two types, private cars versus everything else. This breaks down the everything else of urban trips by type of non-car transportation. In the United States, less than 10% of all trips that people take are by non-car transportation. And that's compared to some countries in Europe where it's well over half of all trips are taken by walking, by bicycling, or by public transportation. The second graph looks at trends in annual public transportation ridership between 1900 and 2000 in the United States. These are the trips per person per year. And as you can see, in the early 50s, trips per person per year numbered around 160. Whereas today, trips per person per year are under 40. The percentage of commuters who commute by car was already high in the United States in 1960, and it's increased ever since, to the point where nearly 90% of commuters in the United States get to work by car. Of course, if that's the case, you'd expect that the annual per capita gas consumption in the United States is way higher than other countries. In Europe, the average person consumes a little over 200 liters. That's about 50 or so gallons of gas a year. In the United States, it's over 1,600 liters. Well, one might think cars, after all, are very convenient. They take you from point to point. You don't have to wait for public transportation. Maybe we're a rich country. We're just deciding to spend our money by buying cars and buying gasoline, and that's just a choice. That's okay. That's one way of organizing transportation. But actually, what this does is creates huge problems of traffic congestion, which have also gotten much worse over time. These are the annual hours of delay per traveler due to traffic congestion across major American cities and how it's changed over the last 25 years or so. The annual hours of delay per traveler in Los Angeles is now over 70 hours a year. That's the equivalent of 2 weeks of work a year. 2 weeks of work a year are lost simply because of delays in congestion. And these are estimates of delays. It's not the commuting time. It's the difference between the commuting time when they're, if you do it at 2 in the morning, so when you can just go straight at the speed limit, versus when you do it as a commuter. 70 hours, it's 2 weeks of extra work a year spent just in traffic congestion. Well, let's look at what's going on here. Now we're going to do a kind of theoretical look at the problem of private versus public transportation around commuting and urban travel. And to do this, we're going to return to our nice friend, the free rider problem, the prisoner's dilemma, the free rider problem, but around public transportation. And it's a kind of interesting case. The numbers I'm going to show you are made up. This is not based on any particular city. It would vary a lot from city to city exactly how this would work. But the numbers will help you understand what's really driving this problem of the public costs of private transportation and how those affect things like congestion. So let's first look at what commuting times are like in a world where you have two choices. You can either take the bus or drive a car. In most American cities, that's the choice for most people. They can get to work by a bus or go shopping on a bus, or they can take a car. So let's look at this example first. And suppose the only thing you worry about is how long it will take. We're going to ignore for this purpose other costs of taking a car, namely owning a car, insurance, parking, gasoline. Let's just assume that the only thing you care about is how long it takes you to get to work. And for many people, I think that is the main concern. The thing they care about is the efficiency of getting from their homes to their work. Okay, if all you care about is time, and this is the world in which you live, this is clearly your favorite option. What you'd like is everyone else to take a bus and for you to take the car, because then there's not going to be a lot of cars on the road because everybody else is taking a bus. You'll take a car and you'll get to work in 10 minutes. Right? So that's the free rider choice. In the case of studying public transportation, the use of the term free rider has this weird meaning, because we're not talking about actually riding. It's just an expression to describe a situation where you are doing the thing that's best for you, but hopes that everyone else does the thing that's best for the collective. You want everybody else to cooperate with the public choice, but you're going to do the private choice. So you drive a car, everybody else takes a bus. That takes you 10 minutes. Your second preference would be to take a bus along with everybody else. That takes 25 minutes to get to work. The worst thing is if everybody else drives a car and you take a bus. That's the worst. The bus takes longer because it stops, and it also takes longer because the roads are congested. The other option is that everybody drives. This is the Los Angeles option. Everybody drives. Now, everybody taking a bus is better than everybody driving. If everybody takes the bus, it takes everybody 25 minutes to get to work. If everybody drives, it takes everybody 45 minutes to get to work. But the best option of all is just driving yourself and hoping that everybody else takes the bus, right? You see why this is the classic kind of collective action problem. It's like the prisoner's dilemma. So your preferences are B, A, D, C. The free riding gain, how much do you gain by everybody else busing and you driving? The free riding gain is 25 minus 10. You get there 15 minutes quicker. The sucker penalty, that's if you're the only one who does the public-spirited thing and takes the bus, but everybody else drives, the sucker penalty is 45 minutes. That's the difference between you and everybody else taking a private car and you alone taking the bus. 45 minutes, 1.5 hours minus 45 minutes. So that's the world in which people make choices when the option is a bus or a car. Now let's look at a different case. Now instead of having a bus and a car, what we have is a rail system of some sort. It could be light rail, it could be a subway system. So imagine a city like New York City with a very good, efficient rail system. The key thing about a rail system is that the trains don't compete with cars on the same roadway. Subways have dedicated roads. We call them tracks. They go underground if they're subways. They go above ground if it's generally called light rail. So it's a very different kind of environment of transportation choices if you've got a good rail system compared to a good bus system, because buses and cars are located in the same space, whereas trains and cars are not. So here again, 10 minutes is how long it takes you to get to work if you take a car and everybody else takes the train. But notice that the advantage isn't so much anymore. It's 15 minus 10, it's only 5 minutes. But here's the thing that changes if you have a rail system. If everybody else is taking a car, so you're getting congestion, it takes 45 minutes to get to work, but it doesn't. The trains aren't competing with the cars. The reason why I say 25 minutes rather than 15, the assumption here is that if very few people are using the trains, they'll come less frequently. So you'll get it'll take you longer to get to work on a subway or a light rail in a system where most people are driving, because less resources will be devoted to this. But now there's no sucker penalty. It actually takes less time to do the train. If you have a good light rail system, what tends to happen is the equilibrium, as everybody makes their choice, is that actually most people begin to use rail, and you end up in this quadrant. If you have a commuting system with good trains, it takes less time to get to work by taking the public transportation than the private transportation. If you have a commuting system with buses, it generally takes more time to get to work. on public transportation than on private transportation. Actually, I want to, I'll come back to this in a moment. I want to show you some clips from the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is precisely about this story. What happens when you switch from a bus system to a light rail system? How many of you know this movie? The basic setup, this is in the late 1940s, and it's about, the actual story is about a neighborhood of Los Angeles called Toontown, where all the cartoon characters live. But the underlying sociological issue in the story is the efforts to transform the transportation system of Los Angeles from a very efficient light rail system to a car-based system. This actually happened in Los Angeles in the 1950s. After World War II, Los Angeles was generally thought of as having the second best, after New York City, public transportation system in the country. General Motors bought up the light rail system, pulled up the tracks, converted it to buses, specifically in order to reduce the efficiency of the public transportation system and make private cars a more attractive choice for people. But here's some clips from Who Framed.
What do I look like, a bank?
So, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is actually an historically, so to speak, accurate account of the fate of public transportation in Los Angeles after World War II. And the key issue, which was illustrated in the previous slides, is that by switching from buses, from light rail to buses, the large corporation in the Toontown case, Cloverleaf Industries, in the real world case of Los Angeles, General Motors, was changing the environment in which people made their own private choices. The change in the environment in which people made their private choices was not something done by the market, it was something done by the exercise of power. General Motors was a powerful corporation. It had the resources to buy up the public transportation system. It did so in connivance with the city council. It worked closely with the local government to do this. Transformed it from an efficient light rail system to a bus system that had to compete with cars on the streets and roads. Reduced the change the trade-offs that individuals faced when deciding what kind of transportation to use. Gradually, people then shifted from public to private transportation. And then they didn't want to pay subsidies as much for the public transportation. They wanted to build more roads. So you get a vicious cycle going on in which people support public spending on highways, but not public spending on public transportation. And as they do so, the public option becomes less and less attractive. That was a scenario which, it turns out, General Motors understood from the start. In hearings on the destruction of the public transportation system in Los Angeles, hearings that were held in a congressional investigation in the 1960s, in those hearings, internal memos from General Motors were revealed that this is what they thought would happen. And they saw it as part of an effort at what is sometimes called the automobilization of American transportation systems, as part of an effort to massively expand the market for their products. Okay, so ultimately, as a collectivity, as a community, we face a choice between public and private transportation and how to put these two kinds of systems together. One way of thinking about this is to think about what are the positive externalities of good public transportation. So just as we talked about negative externalities as the negative side effects of some particular kind of activity, the negative side effects of dumping toxic wastes into a water, we can also think about positive externalities. Positive externalities are all the positive side effects of something, which are not directly always the motivation, but they're a consequence of a particular kind of activity, a positive consequence, a positive externality. If you plant a garden in front of your house with nice flowers, this creates positive externalities for your neighbors. Your neighbors enjoy the improved landscaping and foliage, even though you are beautifying your house because you yourself were getting pleasure from doing so. So it's important in thinking about the costs and benefits, weighing alternatives, to think about the positive externalities of choices and not just the negative externalities. What are the positive side effects? So the most obvious one is quicker commuting times and less congestion, even for people who don't use the public transportation. So it's obvious, I mean, the direct motivation for public transportation is to make it quicker and more efficient for people who need to rely on public transportation. That's the kind of immediate motivation, is to create a way of getting around cities that people can use that's efficient and makes it reasonable for them to make that choice. But a positive side effect is that it actually improves the commuting times, reduces congestion, even for people who don't use public transportation. Traffic congestion is pretty bad in New York City, but just imagine how bad it would be if there wasn't a good public transportation system. And on those rare occasions when there's been a public transportation strike and the public transportation system shuts down for a day or two, people become painfully aware of how hard it would be to get to work if they had to rely exclusively on private transportation. So quicker commuting times would be one of the positive externalities of public transportation. A second positive externality is saving on private car infrastructure. Fewer parking ramps, fewer street repairs. Street repairs are a constant problem in big cities and, for that matter, in small cities. Street repairs are a function of how much traffic is on the street. And one of the positive externalities, one of the costs that are saved by having a good and efficient public transportation system is that you have to repair your streets less frequently. In asking the question, is it worthwhile to have a good and expensive, well-run public transportation system, one of the things you have to ask then is, how much will this save over a 50-year period in the repair of streets? Some things begin to look much less expensive when you count all the costs that are saved by it. Less pollution. Less pollution is one of the consequences of a good public transportation system. Cars are a particularly noxious source of pollution, less so now than in the past because of improved efficiency in cars, but still a source of pollution. And one of the positive externalities, might seem an odd one, is less frequent house painting. Because house painting, the frequency of that you have to repaint a house depends in part upon how much particulate pollution there is in the air around your house. How frequently you have to paint it depends upon the extent of pollution. There have been estimates as to how much is saved in house painting by having less pollution in general in the environment, and a public transportation system would be one contributor to that. Health benefits, especially around asthma, of having a public transportation system. More efficient labor markets, especially for the poor. It's easier to get to jobs, therefore there's less need for welfare. One of the problems in big cities, like Chicago in particular, but many other cities as well, is that the physical location of where poor people can afford housing and where jobs are available, the physical location, makes it difficult for people who could fill certain kinds of low-skilled jobs to get to those jobs. There are many low-skilled jobs in suburban areas, in fast food and in other kinds of retail and other other kinds of employment. But the people who would fill those jobs can't afford to live near them. And if they also can't afford a car, it makes getting to work a significant obstacle to having work. An efficient public transportation system, therefore, improves the efficiency of a labor market. And as a result, reduces the costs needed to provide other forms of financial support for such people. For many people, having a good public transportation system reduces the need for multiple cars in a family. And therefore, it's a direct and immediate savings because of the need for redundant transportation systems. There's still plenty of reasons why people want cars, of course. And arguing for good public transportation is not arguing against having private cars. It simply says that if you have a good and well-run public transportation system, there would be less need for cars, for fewer cars in a family. And of course, perhaps another obvious one, public transportation systems are way more energy efficient than automobile systems as a way of moving people from one part of a city to another. And therefore, a good and efficient public transportation system saves on energy costs. All of these, and you could add other things to this, I'm sure, all of these means that you have, if you're thinking about public versus private transportation and asking what are the costs and benefits of each, you have to be able to assign a true economic value to all of these public, all of these positive externalities. That's a difficult task. You know, many of these are hard to put numbers on, but nevertheless, these are real positive externalities and should be considered part of the equation in assessing the relative merits of having good public and private transportation. Now, the point here is not to force everybody to take public transportation. It's to change the environment in which individuals make their choices. And the environment in which they make their choices is not something which gets spontaneously produced. It's something which we collectively produce. In the case of public transportation, you cannot choose to ride the red car in Los Angeles anymore because the tracks have been pulled up by General Motors. And when the tracks were pulled up by General Motors 60 years ago, the costs of putting the tracks back down becomes enormous. What General Motors did was change the nature of the environment in which people make their private choices. That change in the environment was not done by some mysterious process called the market. It was done by the exercise of power by a powerful organization. The issue that I'm then raising here is that it's true we want people to have the freedom to make their own choices about how to get around, what kind of transportation to use, but we can't leave it up to individuals individually to create the choices that they could make. The set of possibilities can only be generated through some kind of exercise of power, whether it be the power of private corporations or the power of the democratic state. But the power of the democratic state at least has some hope of being responsive to the preferences and priorities of the community at large, rather than simply the preferences and priorities of the owners of a particular economic organization. Let me just begin briefly talking about solutions to the problem of urban traffic congestion. And I will begin the next lecture with discussing these in more, some of these in more detail. All right, so we have in cities public and private ways of getting around. I think it would be better to shift the balance towards more public ways of getting around, strengthen public transportation, and make it a more attractive option for people. What are the ways we can do it? Well, the first thing is to eliminate free parking, because free parking isn't really free. Free parking is created as an incentive to get people to drive cars, but it has to get paid for somewhere. So even when you go to a mall, you know, when you go to a mall in the United States, you expect to have a gigantic parking lot where the parking is free. If you had to pay the true cost, if the individual consumer of that parking space had to pay directly the true cost of parking there, that would create a barrier, an incentive not to drive, right? It would make it make you think twice about whether you were going to drive. Of course, the mall owners want to subsidize your private choice about whether you're going to drive or not by themselves paying for the parking. That's what they're doing. You know, the way it works, it's not that it actually is free to park, because it costs money to produce parking lots, to use the land for that purpose. It's not that it's free, it's just that the mall owners want to pay for the free parking as a way of inducing you to drive to their mall. Well, if we want to change the incentive structures for individuals in transportation choices, one aspect of that is to have a system where parking is charged, where people have to realize, okay, this is a social expense to use this mode of transportation versus another. So one suggestion that's been made for how we could shift the priorities that people have in their choice of transportation modes is to have each person face the full costs of their choices. Note that this is a bit like the idea of having capitalist firms face the true cost of disposing toxic waste. That is, you're saying there are all these externalities of what they're producing. They should pay the full costs. That would lead them to really understand what the alternatives are. In the case of parking, the idea is that that's something that the consumer should face, is the true cost of the choices of transportation they make. And eliminating free parking is one of the ways that you could do that. All right, on Thursday, we'll go through the rest of this.